There's one more thing I want to say about product liability before we move on to professional malpractice, and that is something I haven't highlighted to date. We talked about manufacturing defects. Remember, I put that sort of thing under the heading defects. We can have manufacturing, design, and warning. And I haven't really identified what's unique about a warning defect. Warning defects are very common. Warning defect claims are very common. The advantage to the plaintiff of a warning defect claim, as distinguished from a design defect claim, is that warning defects ask less of the manufacturer. So if you're saying there's something wrong with the design of this product, even adding that little ratchet wheel on the plywood comes at a cost. Maybe you can show that a reasonable person would have spent the money to put that ratchet wheel on the plywood sanding machine. Maybe you can explain why the little teeth marks in the plywood are an acceptable side effect. But you at least have to take that into account, and the manufacturer may come back and show, no, that's too high a price to pay for the rare case in which an injury could be prevented. A warning claim, on the other hand, says, we're not asking you to spend any more money. We're not asking you to change the performance of this product. We're just saying you need to put a warning on the product about the danger. People commonly use their cell phones while they're pumping their gas. Cell phones have, well, they have little electric, you know, they sort of spark. You know, they have a little electric charge. There are cases in which people standing with their cell phone attached to their belt, pumping their gas, the fumes of the gas ignite from the cell phone ringing, and they get engulfed in a fire. Shouldn't they be warned, the purchasers of cell phones, or maybe the purchasers of gasoline should have a warning that shows, you know, a person talking on a cell phone engulfed in flame? A little pictogram there. And again, the whole question about how to put an effective warning. Don't bury the warning 6 pages deep into the owner's manual, which never gets read. Put that warning on the handle of the drill, or, you know, something like that. So again, the difference between a warning claim and a design claim, they're similar in that they both deal with the product line as a whole. It's not just an individual product, as in the manufacturing defect case. And just as with design cases, we don't really have a benchmark to which we can compare this product. We're asking a generic question, would a reasonable person do something different in providing warnings about this product? So again, as you look at a product injury case, you would look not only at a design claim, should we physically alter this product so it performs in a way that's safer, but is there a way that we need to warn consumers about risks associated with using this product? And another thing I would point out that frequently comes up in this area, and it does show up in the exam from time to time, one narrow exception to my rule that you can generally forget about Chapter 2 for purposes of this stuff, is you have to think about whether the warning has made a difference. Oftentimes you can say, gee, in this particular case, the manufacturer didn't provide a warning, but there's evidence that the consumer wouldn't have change their behavior, either because they already knew about the danger and warning them would be superfluous, or for some other reason a warning would have been ineffective or is not a but-for cause of the injury. Going back to the baby oil case, if I've described that before, where the mom, after the kid starts sputtering with this stuff in his mouth, the mom goes up looks at the bottle, reads the label on the bottle, and doesn't find any warning about something serious. And that's why she says she took no further action. If she hadn't read the warning label, you would say, well, so what if it had a, you know, unless her testimony is the lack of that language about the danger of aspiration made a difference in the way she handled that case, her testimony was that it was. And again, juries have to assess the credibility of the plaintiff, who very conveniently remembers something where the lack of a warning made a difference. How many people actually sit down with their new cordless drill and read through page by page all the different warnings about its use? Not many. And yet that might be the basis upon which you say the lack of a warning about this particular kind of risk. That if I use my cordless drill with a paddle on it to stir up, you know, a paint thinner, and then the spark ignites the paint thinner, gee, I didn't know about that. Yeah. Okay, so that, any other questions about product liability? Obviously, you know, two chapters to go and 2 hours and 30 minutes here, yeah.
Briefly, in regard to the state section on disclaimers, limitations, and waivers,
yeah.
Can you? I read that to say that basically those are of no use to manufacturers.
Well, again, the idea is that disclaimers are disfavored as a matter of public policy. That just going back to Henningsen, the idea that I could sell you a product and you would agree, either expressly or because you signed something which theoretically was after you had read it and you agreed to it, the idea that you could relieve me, the manufacturer, of a duty to provide you with a reasonably safe product, most of the time we say, wow, that's really nutty. Now, there are limited cases, you know, if I sell hang gliders or I sell, you know, whatever, some exotic part for some really high-risk activity, where it might be conscionable, acceptable public policy, the person I'm selling it to can relieve me of this duty. But most of the time, again, as I was saying to Mr. Totter earlier about these different models, the desire to let people cut their own deals is often outweighed by the concern that people are going to get exploited. That if we allow disclaimers to be recognized in the law, we'll start to see a lot of them, and vulnerable people are going to get taken advantage of because they're in a poor bargaining position. Okay, now, professional malpractice. This area of law, we've already had some contact with it in Helling versus Carey, and can't think of any other. We've had a couple of other malpractice cases. But we haven't talked about the standards to be applied. And let me just outline these for you. There are two basic issues in professional malpractice. The first is the standard of care. That is, in what respect is this different from swatting a wasp? Where we would simply ask the jury to evaluate the defendant's conduct according to a standard of reasonable care. And if the jury thinks the doctor behaved reasonably, fine. If the jury believes the doctor was negligent, the doctor is found liable. I'm using doctor here sort of generic. We're also talking about other health care professionals, you know, nurses, what have you, dentists, etc. But I'll sort of use doctor as the generic defendant here. So the first question is, what's the standard of care? We'll talk about that in some detail. The second question is, what about this business of informed consent? In what respect does this differ from an ordinary negligence claim? The main area in which it differs is that A doctor can perform a procedure with great skill, meeting the standard that we would expect of a doctor functioning in that role. But if the doctor doesn't do it with the informed consent of the patient, it's malpractice. So if I'm a dermatologist or plastic surgeon, great skill at removing tattoos, I can be guilty of malpractice if I do an exquisitely professional job of removing a tattoo if the patient wanted to keep it. That's a lack of informed consent. So, again, we have to figure out, well, okay, now what is it? What is the doctor's duty with respect to what is true information, what is true consent? So let's start with the standard of care and this case of, what is this thing called? Knight versus Haydary. Volunteers here to tell us about Patricia Knight and her. Yeah.
Okay, she had DNC, and then when she was recovering, she received some solution that would rehydrate her along with Pitocin.
Yes.
And she received...
Pitocin's a very, very commonly used hormone to stimulate childbirth, whatever you... labor. You think I know. She's in the hospital getting this treatment. Then what happens?
She begins to feel nauseous, vomiting, and she reports it to her physician. And then she has a seizure. And basically the claim is,
she continues to complain about her symptoms that she feels really terrible. And the doctor's response is?
The doctor just assumes that that has to do with the procedure that's happened and side effects from the drugs and maybe even emotional.
Right. Yeah, she's just upset, you know, she'll get over it. In fact, they call a psychiatrist to deal with her. And it turns out, what's wrong with her?
It turns out that she has hyponatremia that has to do with the sodium and water balance in her cells. Her brain actually swells because of this.
Yes. So she has a very serious physical problem, and the doctors respond essentially by saying, well, it's all in your head, so to speak, but it's not in her emotional life, it's actually this terrible condition that kills her. Okay, so her grieving husband now says, you doctors committed malpractice. And so the question before the House is, By what standard of care do we judge the doctor? And the answer is?
Whether or not the duty to diagnose, whether or not use the standard of care to diagnose what he thought, given the circumstances.
And in what respect, if any, does this differ from the WASP case? WASP flies in, jury looks at how the defendant reacted to it and says thumbs up or thumbs down. How does it differ from that?
It differs from that in that it's what a physician in that position would have.
Okay, the jury has a derivative role here. They have to form their judgment based upon the opinions of experts. So the first thing we need is that this is based on expert opinion. No matter how obvious it might appear to you or to me that the doctors blew it in this case, we can't form that, if we're on the jury, we can't form that judgment by ourselves. We've got to get qualified medical experts to tell us this either was or was not within the standard of care. Standard of care of whom? Okay. Of a sort of similarly situated doc. Again, same standard would be applied to a dentist or a nurse or a physical therapist or what have you. Similarly situated, okay, I'll just put healthcare practitioner. So, as you say, if we're talking about an OBGYN, it's a, what would a reasonably prudent OBGYN do under those circumstances? We do not want to be in a situation where we're holding a general practitioner. Suppose this guy was making a house call, he's a country family doctor with a general practice, shows up to a woman who's experiencing these things, and then we bring in an OBGYN from a city hospital and say, oh, well, if I were in that situation, I would do X, Y, and Z. We want to compare apples to apples. If this is an OBGYN, we want to find another OBGYN to tell us what we should expect. What's the testimony in this case?
In this case, the expert says that there's probably over 100 conditions that could be associated with headache, nausea, vomiting.
Now, whose expert is this? The defendant's expert, okay. And so the defendant's expert's bottom line is? You could be exercising reasonable care and miss this once. Real easy to miss, says the defendant's expert. What does the plaintiff's expert say?
The plaintiff's expert said that it was something that he should have known.
Yeah. Yeah. Hang him by the nearest yardarm. He's a quack. Get rid of him. Doesn't quite say it that strongly. But you have this classic battle of the experts. On the one hand, the defendant's expert who says this was within the standard of reasonable care. Sure, with 20/20 hindsight, we wish we had done things differently, but that doesn't say that this guy was negligent. I don't think he was negligent, says the defendant's expert. Plaintiff's expert says just the opposite. And again, one of the classic sort of puzzles about the modern American tort litigation system is, as between apparently this, I would assume, board-certified OBGYN expert for the plaintiff and this board-certified OBGYN expert for the defendant, who can't agree on the standard of care, who's going to resolve that conflict? Yeah, the brake repair guy and the lady who works as a janitor for the school district, and it's kind of nutty when you think about it, but that's our system. So your job in a professional malpractice case is you first of all have to find experts. Again, you get out 1-800-EXPERT. And you call them up and you scour the country to find somebody who will testify for your client, and you try to find the one that's going to have the most resonance with the jury. Ideally, you find someone from your own community. In the old days, you had to find somebody from your own community. It was the old locality rule. The locality rule said it's not enough to find somebody who's an OBGYN. You've got to find an OBGYN who knows how medicine is practiced in Spokane, or in Republic, Washington, or in Wenatchee, or in Othello, or in, you know, wherever. And oftentimes there were like three people that fit that description, and if none of those three people felt like testifying against the defendant for good reason, they were partners, or, you know, they traded call, or they, you know, their kids were in the same daycare together, or, you know, whatever, they don't want to testify, that minute was impossible to find an expert. But in the modern era, you can go out and find experts. Ideally, though, you'd like to have somebody from your own community, so it doesn't look like, you know, you kept putting money in the jukebox until it played the song you wanted to hear. You want to show that this is an honest, objective expert. But in the end, when the plaintiff has their expert and the defendant has their expert, the jury makes a decision, and essentially the parties are stuck with that. That's what the court says in this case. They're not going to overturn the jury's verdict, even though one would think, reading this evidence, that the patient in this case didn't get very good medical care. Maybe it's a rare condition, but it killed her. Couldn't you have at least checked that out before you said she was, you know, having emotional problems? Come on. If that's your reaction when you read this, you got to remind yourself, oh yeah, but the jury's the ultimate one. And the jury may be reluctant to look that physician in the eye and say, you negligently caused this woman's death. That's a, you know, you probably need a little bit of fire in the belly to be able to say that. And where the evidence is ambivalent, equivocal, you may be reluctant to pull the trigger. What people say, I haven't checked this statistic out, but what people say is that of the cases that actually, medical malpractice cases that go to trial, only 1 in 4 cases are successful for the plaintiff. 3 in 4 cases return with verdict for the defendant. Maybe that's because all the good cases settle out and all you have left over are the dogs. I don't know what the reason is, but it may also be the juries, again, unless the evidence is pretty strong, the jury may be reluctant after seeing Dr. So-and-so day after day after day, if the doctor is somebody other than some, you know, jerk that they want to beat up themselves, if the doctor is somewhat sympathetic, the jury may be reluctant to say, hey, Dr. So-and-so, you're responsible for this woman's death. And if that's the jury's verdict, that's the jury's verdict. Okay. That is the gist of the idea of standard of care. First of all, it's not my opinion, it's the expert's opinion, and it's going to be a battle of the experts. You've got to find the expert who's going to persuade the jury, and I might say, as a matter of professional preparation, those of you who think about those of you who already been involved in, you know, personal injury litigation, who've seen it done and so forth, or you're thinking about doing it, one of the primary things that you need to be good at to be a successful personal injury litigator is learning how to examine and cross-examine experts. You know, the care and feeding of experts is a big part of modern tort litigation. Economists, you know, doctors, you know, et cetera. How to get their testimony, how to, you know, question their credibility, how to present them to the jury in a favorable light, how to translate all this complex technical stuff into bite-sized stuff the jury can get hold of and be persuaded by. That's a key part of winning your case. So, you know, we tend to see in these Perry Mason moments, I guess people, I don't know if people still watch Perry Mason anymore, but, or, you know, Law and Order, whatever, these dramatic, you know, confrontations in court of people breaking down, admitting that they're lying or whatever, but oftentimes the real bread and butter of this stuff is figuring out, well, what did this expert say, and, you know, how do I discredit that or create a better impression. Okay, now let's move on and talk about informed consent. And Mrs. Wachter and her encounter with Dr. Billy. Jean Wachter, I guess. Anybody want to take on Jean Wachter? Okay, so just the technology here, your coronary artery is the one that actually carries the blood to your heart, right? Okay, and if that gets clogged and you don't get enough blood to your heart, you're in big trouble. So they basically want to replace that piece of plumbing, this pipe, this vein, this artery, with another piece of plumbing from elsewhere in your system. And there are two choices, apparently. Or at least, at the time, she was only presented with one choice, and the question is whether she should have been presented with the other choice. What's the choice that she was presented with?
She was only presented with the choice to take the veins from her legs.
Yes.
And the other choice that wasn't presented to her at the time was the procedure where you take the chest or the breast.
Yeah. So this the IMA procedure as opposed to the SVG. Again, two different sources of this little piece of plumbing. And so you stitch it on or, you know, attach it so that now you'll get adequate blood flow. They did one SVG procedure, and what happened after the SVG procedure?
It failed.
Yeah. And I don't know exactly what the reasons for it, whether it gets clogged or it didn't work, or for whatever reason, that was unsuccessful, and now they got to try again. It's at that point that she makes the claim.
She makes the claim. Well, she has to go back in for another surgery, and they present her with a new doctor, and they do not tell her about the IMA procedure. She goes ahead.
Okay, and her claim is that malpractice was committed
by not necessarily that the procedure failed, but that she was not she did not give them informed she did not receive informed consent as to the alternative of the IMA and also as to the shortcomings of the physician that performed the surgery.
Right. And we eventually, this Billig turned out to be there was some sort of investigative report about the poor care in military hospitals, and he was sort of Exhibit A about this, sort of the butcher of Bethesda, and all of his lack of success. But that drops out of the case, and the real thing we're concerned about now is, was she deprived of the opportunity to make an informed choice about whether to continue to try again with the SVG or to do the IMA procedure?
And the court held that she was not. Right.
Okay. And let's establish the standard by which we judge this. What is the physician's obligation when the physician is contemplating, the patient is contemplating some kind of medical procedure? What's the healthcare professional's obligation?
To inform her of other reasonable procedures.
Okay. The first thing, actually, when we're thinking about the SVG procedure, and the doctor, in effect, is recommending, I think what you need is another SVG procedure, The first thing we have to do is talk about the risks of that procedure. So again, the material risks associated with this procedure. It must be 12 years ago when my daughter, who's now 16, was about 3 years old. Her front teeth had decayed almost to the gum line. And the dentist said, you know, I really want to replace those teeth. I want to put, even though they're baby teeth, I want to replace them with teeth that will allow her to, you know, speak normally and so forth. I normally do this in the office, said the doctor, but the dentist, but I'd prefer to do it. I'd actually like to knock her to do general anesthesia and have her in the hospital and just do a little outpatient procedure so that I don't have to worry about having her, you know, conscious or whatever, trying to do it in my office. So he said, okay, that's your recommendation. Well, to do that, we had to go to the hospital. We had to make an appointment. We had to go watch a movie. Little movie about general anesthesia. This is standard operating procedure at Sacred Heart Hospital. If you're going to go under general anesthesia, they schedule you for a showing of this little video, and it tells you, well, general anesthesia, we use these different things, so and so on. Every once in a while, they say, you know, they show the little kid going in with the balloons, you know, and this, but every once in a while there's serious injury or death. But normally after the operation, okay. There is a risk when you go under general anesthesia. That has to be disclosed. And again, what's a material risk? That a meteor is going to fall in the hospital during the procedure? That, you know, what? That we're going to have a power failure? That, I don't know, earthquake? What's a material risk? What is a risk that a reasonable person would want to know about before deciding on this procedure? Okay, what else do we have to tell the patient about?
Alternative therapies.
Yes.
The patient must be informed of alternative courses of treatment, how they compare in order to make informed choices.
And again, what's a reasonable alternative? Psychic surgery in the Philippines? You know, Laetril down in Guadalajara? You know, where do we find? How about homeopathy? What about alternative? What about Christian Science? What about, you know, what are the different ways that people respond to disease conditions? Again, the standard is, what would a reasonable person want to know about? Does the IMA fit within an alternative therapy about which a reasonable person would have wanted to know?
The majority held that it didn't.
Why not?
It was only used by, it wasn't a mainstream procedure. It was only offered in 20% of hospitals. The 20% was a question as to whether it was, but 20% of the hospitals in the United States.
Yeah. Now, the dissenting opinion disagrees and thinks that's a big enough number to say, well, gee, when my life is at stake, when the SVG procedure has failed once, shouldn't I at least be told about the fact maybe I've got to move to a different city to get this procedure done? But that's not something people would rule out of question. There's another reason the majority gives for not buying into this informed consent issue.
Was it no material injury flow? There wasn't an injury because...
Why not?
There's no proof that the IMA would have been better for her than the SPD, and that it was...
There's another problem. No, there's another reason why she really can't complain about the doctor not telling her, at least according to the majority. Surely knew about it. That, again, you can only claim, gee, if you told me about this IMA thing, I would have gone for it. Well, wait a minute, lady, you already looked this up, and you knew about it yourself. Now, you could still take a more charitable view of the plaintiff's claim to say, it's different when I read about it on the Internet, than when my physician tells me. If my physician tells me about something, it has more credibility than if, you know, if the physician doesn't even tell me about it, I assume, well, gee, that's probably some crazy thing on the internet that I assume wasn't mainstream. And if 20% of the hospitals are doing this procedure, that's pretty mainstream for me, this plaintiff might say. So, again, a close question on this case as to whether or not she met the standard of saying, I wasn't given adequate disclosure before I signed on the dotted line. Now, I would say this principle of informed consent applies not only in the medical context, but it applies to you as lawyers. You know, when your client has a problem, brings you something about which they want advice, you owe your client the disclosure of the alternatives that they have. In fact, if you read a civil action, I don't know that it's highlighted as much in the movie, but I think it is sort of in the post-mortem of what went wrong. One of the major complaints of Jan Schlickman's clients was that he didn't keep them adequately informed. He was out there swashbuckling away trying to get a victory, but his clients weren't kept in the loop. As he got, you know, further and further into the swamp, got more and more desperate, instead of checking back with his clients to say, here's the latest, here's where I am, what should we do now, he made all those decisions for them. And they didn't like that one bit. So oftentimes, physicians get into trouble not so much because they're not skilled at what they do. It's not just that with 20/20 hindsight, I kind of missed that one. The way you stay in good with your patients or your clients or what have you is when you treat them as real, well, as though you report to them rather than vice versa. That you tell them how things are going and that they feel as though they control the action rather than they're simply a cog in your grand machine. So a lot of it is simply the relationship, maintaining the relationship between you and your client in a way that's respectful and healthy rather than one in which your client sort of gets left in the dust while you're busily trying to put out all the fires that are raging in your office. Tomorrow, I want to spend a brief time going over a couple of highlights of the Washington statute. Again, just for illustrative purposes, as with product liability, the Washington legislature tried to make things nice and smooth and crystal clear. I think they did a better job here than they did in product liability. But then we'll go on to Chapter 11, finish up Chapter 11, and be done.
Here's the handout for the tutorial at noon and the one on Thursday. For the rest of the chapter. Yeah.